wife was sick. Anyway, okay. Gibaldic. Today we're going to do something a little bit unusual, which I don't usually do. But it's important in this Perek. So we're going to. You're not going to need a Daf Makoros for a while. First thing we need to talk about in Hazav, as in I want to talk about two things today if I have time. We're going to pretend that I have time. Is a little bit about how the monetary system worked in the time of Chazal, because as anybody who has started Hazav already will realize, it's a mess, right? Their monetary system did not work the way ours did, and it makes a big difference in terms of understanding the Gemaras. Then I want to talk about Kinyan Kesef in Mitalsalem, because that is, in fairness, the first Mishnah. Okay? Or at least that is the unspoken Shibboleth in the first Mishnah. Okay? So in terms of the monetary system in the time of Chazal, does anybody know how it worked? Anything at all? What the...
Sorry? There are coins that had values.
There are coins that had values. It's true.
But you still have coins that have values today.
Yes. They were worth how much they weighed, usually.
Theoretically, we'll talk about that.
But they could.
Okay, their weight was at least theoretically related to their value.
If you could exchange them between each other and they don't have a necessarily fixed exchange rate, they have an exchange rate.
What do you mean they don't have a fixed exchange rate? They have an exchange rate?
This is worth 24.
You don't always get exactly
for shekels
for a deep for all four.
Yes, exactly. Why not?
Because sometimes the coins are worn away or something.
Or adulterated. Yes, if you were about to say something?
The one silver coin is worth 24 of the, I forget what the metal is, and the 25 silver is worth one gold. So it fixed exchange rate.
Okay, so very good. So here is the problem, right? I don't have a picture. I'm going to deal with that one. Oh, I do have one. Excellent. Apparently, I read some research. I was very, very bored when I was doing this, so my phone was not functioning properly, so I couldn't learn anything. I was reading some research about colours on the whiteboard. It turns out that green is one of the hardest colours to remember. Fine. So, I assume you used this for this.
No, I used that for it.
Just ripping it up? Anyway. So, we have a problem, right? On the one hand, coins have a fixed value, right? This is the fundamental assumption of any monetary system. Are you in economics at all? Oh, good, so I don't have to be embarrassed in what I'm saying in front of you.
Go ahead. Be as embarrassed as you like.
Oh, thank you. Anyway, the fundamental value... I actually was in economics in Australia. I was an economics major in Australia, so... I know a little bit. Not that much, but a little bit of what I'm talking about here. Right, coins and any monetary system have to have a fixed value. Why?
Otherwise you can't exchange goods.
Very good. Otherwise they're not a valid medium of exchange, right? If I know something's worth $5, right, I'm assuming that $5 is a value that I actually know what that means. Right? If it means something that's essentially arbitrary, it doesn't help. And nobody's going to use it. Right? Now, the reason for this is because monetary systems rely on confidence. Okay. This is really at the core of the essentially nonsense that we call money. Right? Money doesn't exist. It really doesn't, right? If you think about the way we conduct ourselves today, on a daily basis, right? The truth is, in the past, it was better, right? Because what would I do? I'd go to a store with, say, a $5 bill, right? And I would give it to them, and I'd buy, I don't know, however many, let's say, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, when people did this on a regular basis, right? You would get 100 candies more, right? For $5, you'd get a lot. No? Now it's even worse. I go in and I go and I put and I give my credit card, and because it's imaginary. There's literally nothing that happens. But even before, what did I give them? I gave them a piece of paper. No? And the piece of paper has no value. Like none. Its entire value is what we as a society assume it has. Right? Now, this is just as true for coins. Right? A coin, which is, let's say, a gold coin or a silver coin. I'm going to work mostly with the silver dinar or denarius because it was the most common coin in the Roman Empire used as a medium of exchange. Well, it was the most common standard coin used throughout the empire as a medium of exchange, right? And it's the one that Chazal talk about the most. They say it is the most coin-like of all coins, right? The silver dinar was worth, by law, 4 grams of silver. That was the silver content of the coin. Any other metal in the coin was something else. Okay? Which means that theoretically, when you get a silver dinar, you have to have confidence that it's actually got 4 grams of silver in it, because you know that 4 grams of silver is worth however much weight. Right? And the silver dinar is just a very convenient way of carrying it around, because it means you don't really need scales. Right? You can just sort of use the coins, right? You can assume they mean what they say they mean. Yeah? In if that's the case, right, then anything which diminishes confidence is going to be a problem from the perspective of a monetary system. Right? A tremendous amount of time in Perkazar is spent on dealing with various things which diminish confidence in coins. Okay? They tend to be called a Mois problem. Kumois, right? That means if a coin... Right? Mois. Kumois. Is a coin that we don't have confidence in it. Right? We take one look at it and we no longer have confidence it means it is worth what it says it's worth. Okay. Yeah? Just quickly, reasons why you might have a lack of confidence that a coin is worth however much it says it is.
Inflation.
No, we're talking about the. We'll get to that.
You see that it doesn't have the value.
I'm sorry.
You see that it doesn't have the value.
What an example would be?
Rusted.
Okay, tarnished, right? Right. A good example is a tarnished coin, right? And tarnish can be a problem from two perspectives. Either you can see that some of the silver has gone away, it has been reduced to silver oxide, right? And while now we have a good trick to deal with that particular issue in the time of Chazal, they didn't. Right? The way you can polish silver without losing any of the silver off it, a silver polish, by the way, it rubs off silver, so polishing it doesn't help. Right? There is a way to do it without losing silver, but fine, they didn't know about that. What's another possibility? The other thing a tarnish does is a tarnish covers the symbol. Right? If it's severely tarnished, you're just not going to be able to see how much it's worth.
Why is sewer so on that? Like, is sewer on the coin a problem if it's just the weight?
Very good. Can anybody answer the question? Why? I wasn't going to talk about this yet, but let's talk about it. A sea mine, right? Another case which is problematic is an RC mine. Why is a coin, let's assume an RC mine is like what most of them think it is, a coin without a picture on it. Why is that a problem?
Nobody's saying that it's a coin.
What do you mean?
If everybody agrees that something doesn't have value, then it doesn't have value, and it's not going to go far in terms of trading goods.
Yes, exactly. Right. An RC coin may have been issued by the government, but I don't know that. Don't know who issued it. As a result, even if you can tell more or less how much it's got in it by the size, which you probably can, right? You'd probably sort of look at it and work out how much metal there is in it based on the size, right? Assuming at least that most coins are fairly pure, we'll get to in a minute, right? But you don't have confidence that the value is exact and the exact value matters, right? Right? Again, no confidence. What's another reason why a coin might we might lose confidence in a coin. I take your coin.
It's old, then it might be a sure new one. Doesn't
know what it says. So, sort of, but we'll get to it, right? Why the question of why an old coin is problematic is not obvious based on what I just said, right? Because its value doesn't go down all on its own. What's another problem?
You can just see that some of it's worn away and it's smaller than
the coin is worn down, and that can happen either through regular wear and tear, it could have been bumped, whatever, right? Just in a normal course of events. These coins are made of relatively soft metal, right? They can be worn down. Or alternatively, somebody could have filed them, right? Somebody could have actually run basically a nail file around the edge of the coin to take off a little bit of the metal, right? Which was a way of quite literally making new money, but in the process it diminished the value of the coins that we have. Now, since we rely on the coin's actual value being the same as their token value, that's a very, very serious problem. And by the way, this was a very serious criminal offence in both the Roman and Roman medieval kingdoms for that reason, because it undermines if it's done commonly, it undermines confidence in the entire monetary system, and people stop using money and they go back to barter. Right, which is bad for everybody. Okay? So this can be a very serious problem. What else? Gabriel?
I don't know if this ever happened, but if they hit a lot of gold and silver at the same time, then each individual piece of gold and silver is worth a lot less.
You mean they minted? So you could theoretically diminish the value of coins by minting a great deal of them, that's true, and creating an oversupply. I don't know of any case of it happening. As in modern time, it happens regularly.
Right.
That's what the problem with minting too much money. I don't know of a case of hyperinflation in ancient times. You'd have to have a really like, tremendous quantity of silver to pull that one off.
Right, that's why I said I don't think it happens. I don't know if they get like.
Yeah, the reason why it's so easy to do that now is because
right.
Our money is essentially fictional.
Uh-huh.
I
suppose it's possible that you could suspect it being mixed in with other metals.
Okay, very good. This is the third one, and this is important, adulteration. Okay. Adulteration means mixing a metal into the coin that shouldn't be there. So, for example, a silver coin, you can keep it looking like silver by mixing in lead. But lead is a vastly less valuable metal than silver. Right? Okay, here is where it gets complicated, right? Everything I said here, the monetary system relies on people having confidence that coins are worth what they say they're worth. Right? Right. We're all going to assume that these coins are worth what they say they're worth. Now, in modern times, it's very easy. A $5 bill is worth exactly $5. The reason why is because its value is completely arbitrary. Right? We simply assign it a value. No? In the time of the Roman Empire, its value was not arbitrary, its value was tied to its weight, right? So we have to assume that the weight is the same as what it claims to be. This was very rarely true, right? From the earliest times, this value of a dinar being worth exactly 4 grams of silver was a law instituted by Lucius Cornelius Sulla about 50 years before the Common Era. And from then until the breakup of the Roman Empire, it never changed. But in reality, it was almost never abided by either. So in the time of Augustus, who was the founder of the Roman Empire, effectively, Roman coins, in fact, had about 3.7 grams of silver in them. A couple hundred years later, they have closer to 2 grams of silver in them. Right? So this was being done by the government. What happens when the government is adulterating coins? What's going to be the result of that? And people are no longer sure how much. I guess people are going to lose confidence, right? Except for life is never quite that simple, right? People will lose confidence in the value of the coins, and that's exactly what happened. But, on the other hand, by this stage, coins have been used throughout the known world for almost 1,000 years. Right? For basically everything. Coins underpin the entire economy. Nobody can even think about living without coins anymore, literally. right? It's literally become inconceivable. Right? Even to this day, when a country when the economy of a country collapses, right, and they stop using the currency because they lose faith in the currency because of hyperinflation, typically. So, what do they do?
Dollar.
Very good. They start using US dollars. They don't stop using coins. They don't go back to barter. People have such a heavily ingrained habit of using coins, and they can't really stop. But they've lost confidence. Right? So what do they now, how do they deal with the situation? You no longer assume a coin is worth what it says it's worth, right? You basically assign a theoretical value to the coin, which is not even close to its token value, to allow for the eventuality that the coin is not worth anywhere near what it says it's worth. Yeah? Sure.
Was there any way of... Well, it must be there, but what was the way of testing a coin to find out whether it was adulterated? If putting lead in it makes it look like silver and so it's going to weigh 4 grams, how would you know it's got lead in it?
The coin didn't weigh 4 grams. The coin had 4 grams of silver in it. It had other metals in it always.
Ah.
Silver on its own is a highly volatile metal. It reacts strongly with air. It's, you, I assume, have silver at home? How often do you polish?
Regularly, quite often.
I'm guessing once every 2-3 weeks, right? We do a little less here because the water area here is drier, but still once every month or two. Everything needs to be polished. The problem is that when you polish silver, the best way to polish silver, let's say the easiest way to polish silver, is by rubbing it with polish, which they had in those times. But the polish is actually what's called an abrasive. Meaning the way it works is it quite literally physically rubs off the tarnish. The tarnish is chemically silver oxide. Which means that you're losing silver when you do this, when you perform this process. If you were to do this for 1,000 years, your filter would be browned, it would be ground, worn down to nothing. It just happens to be, you know, not usually a problem that we worry about so much. Because the quantities that we're losing in the process of polishing are minute. But over time, it can come up. Like I said, there is a way to avoid the problem, but it's a little bit more complicated.
So what's the answer to the question? How would you tell? Okay, so the coin already had other metals in it apart from silver. So
the only way you can do it is you have to adulterate it. So the way you have to do it is you melt down the coin. But the only way to tell is you can melt down the coin, and then different metals have different weights. Right? But that's not such a practical solution. That's a very practical solution if you anyway want to melt down the coins. But if you've decided you anyway want to melt down your coins to use the metal for something else, that means that you have a certain amount of metal that you need. Right? Which means that we get right back to the original problem that you need to have some confidence that the coins are worth what they say they're worth. But you don't.
But if people weren't melting down their coins, which would erase the face from them and make them out...
Well, they sometimes would.
Then what, how did they know that they were, that the coins were adulterated? How did they lose confidence if they didn't know their coins were adulterated?
Of course they knew their coins were adulterated. If the mint is adulterating coins, people are going to know about it. You know, over the course of hundreds of years. Like, it's not the sort of thing that's going to be out of case. We're talking about many, many workers. Like, it's not possible to keep it a secret. Right? Remember, it's also...
If everyone continues to using the coins that they don't have confidence in, why does it matter?
Because they were using it on the assumption that the coin had a certain value.
But if everyone knows it no longer has a certain value, then if they continue using it, like... As in, like, who cares, like, what it's actually worth? It's all that matters is what they assume it's worth.
So, inachinami, theoretically, that is true, and we will get to it. Well, I'll also get to in a minute why it does matter very, very much. Right? In other words, when they find out what's going to happen, actually, and what did happen is, when they find out it's adulterated, they're going to jack up prices once. Right? Then it's, you know, remains adulterated. They won't believe you anyway if you tell them it's not adulterated anymore, but they're not going to jack up prices anymore. Right? Because they've already allowed for the fact that it's adulterated. Right, so you're right, it's only going to cause a problem once. We'll get to why it causes a problem basically continuously in a minute. Right? This gets us to the next way in which the Roman monetary system was significantly more complicated than ours. Who mints the money now?
US mint.
The US government. The Israeli government. The British government. Doesn't matter. The government. The central government is the only one that's entitled to mint money. If anybody else mints money, that's called counterfeiting. It's illegal. Right? The reason why is because the government wants to have some control of how much money there is in the economy. In the time of the Roman Empire, the central government in Rome, right, central government would mint money. Like I said, typically heavily adulterated. But in addition to the central government, every provincial governor, without any exceptions, would mint money. Now, by law, they were only allowed to mint copper or bronze coins, not gold and silver. The central government minted no copper and bronze, it only minted gold and silver. The provincial governors only minted copper and bronze. The reason why, so when the central government is paying its bills are enormous, it's not going to pay less than a gold or silver coin. Right? A provincial governor, which is paying its workers sort of a daily wage, they need copper already, because copper is how you're going to buy food. Yeah? But, right? Many provincial governors were granted a special permission to mint silver coins, right? Which they would then stamp with the symbol of that provincial governor instead of the government in Rome, instead of the SPQR, right? And in addition, right, many of them minted silver and gold coins even if they weren't allowed to. And that could get them in big trouble if they were caught, but in the meantime, they make a lot of money, so they were willing to take the risk. As a result, you have a lot of coins floating around. Now, let's say we've been minting coins that are heavily adulterated for the last couple of hundred years, so we've worked out they have, let's say, 2 grams of silver in them instead of the regular 4, right? And so everybody knows they have 2 grams in silver instead of the regular 4. So no problem, we've basically solved the problem, right? But what happens when a provincial governor now comes along and prints a coin with mints a coin with only 1.5 grams of silver in it? Or, for that matter, 2.3 grams of silver?
The system's broken.
Right? It's a mess. Right? So, the way it worked in practice, and there's a Kim'at Befebrish Yerushalmi in the first parak of Maaser Sheni, which actually says this. Right? Within a given province, they would accept either the central government coins or the provincial governor's coins as being what they said they were. Right? People would tend to accept that it was worth however much upset it was, because as Gabriel accurately pointed out, as long as we all know what's going on, as long as we anyway attribute a certain amount of value to the coin, who cares? Right? Until somebody comes along and tries to mint down the coin, which was melt down the coin to use it for something else, which was did happen but was relatively unusual, right? It doesn't matter anyway. The problem becomes when you now take that coin into a different province, where that governor doesn't have any authority. If you know how much the coin is worth, that's great. Who cares? It doesn't matter what symbol is stamped on it. But if you have no idea how much metal this coin in fact has in it, then what are you going to do? You're going to assume it has the lowest possible value. Right? And you're going to have to change it for coins that are actually accepted in that province. Which means suddenly that inter-provincial trade is horrifically expensive. Okay? And all of these coins are sort of all floating around the system. By the way, the same sort of thing, I don't know the details as well in the Sasanian Persian Empire, which is where the Babylonian Amorim were living, but the same sort of thing was happening. Right, that I do know, I looked it up. Right, so the details might be a little bit different, but Lamaisa. That is the situation, this whole very complicated situation where you have multiple people minting different coins, which all say they mean the same thing, but in fact are not the same thing. Right? It's a situation we're dealing with, and this is why Chazal are having so much trouble working out how much coins are worth, right, and which coins can be used to buy what, right, and which coins people have more confidence in. This is why these issues are issues of such importance, which coins are more accepted, right? Precisely because of these issues, because there was very, very little confidence in the monetary system. But people were basically forced to use it anyway. Okay.
But why isn't Mishnayos?
Don't understand the question.
Isn't Mishnayos like, well, it's just random things? Isn't it just like Jewish law?
No. Isn't it reflects the reality they lived in? I don't think they went out to describe the monetary system with that. A significant portion of everything I just said, you didn't know about until I said it, right?
Yeah.
But having said that, they, when they're describing Jewish law, right, a halacha, they're going to describe it based on their experience of reality. They're applying halacha in their reality. By the way, chelek lokatan, a significant portion of the problems that Rishonim have in working out sugyos in this perek is exactly because of these issues. Because by their time, things were significantly more standardized, right? And usually it was only central government that minted coins, which means that you knew how much a coin was worth based on which country it had come from, right? Which means that they had a serious problem understanding some of the issues that Chazal were having. The other thing that they worked out in the medieval period was they worked out how to prevent people from filing down the coin. Remember, we talked about that people would file down a coin. So has anybody noticed the ridges around coins? They're there for exactly this reason. If somebody files down a coin which is ridged around the edge, then you know immediately it's been filed. It's almost impossible to replicate that shape without reminting the coin, which is frankly more than the coin's worth. Or at least more than the gold you're going to get from filing it down. It should be noted that, of course, immediately, once I've said that, there were people who then worked out how to do that too. They did it through a very similar process of tarnishing silver. As in, what they would do is they would tarnish it, then they would dissolve the tarnish into water using a chemical process, and then they would restore the silver from that water. And therefore, the coin would maintain its original shape. They didn't know that was what they were doing. They didn't know the chemical details, but that was what they were doing. Okay, fine. That is Chelak Aleph in terms of Hakdama to the Perek. I just think it's important to understand the Matzias. That way you can... I think it should help you understand the Gemara's better. At least it helps me. Derech Agav, if there's anybody who's interested... What I explain now, I think, is the Ikarei Dvarim. If anybody is interested, there is a book that's available for free online. Anybody who wants, I'll send you the PDF. It is called The Judeo-Claudian and Flavian Coins from Rome's Municipal Urban Excavations, Observations of Coin Circulation in the Cities of Latium Vetus and Campania in the first century AD. Yeah. It's a good book. I am about halfway through it. I started reading it at the beginning of the year. Bleakesher.
They're starting what?
Oh, no. We're like in the middle. Okay, I don't think you need to read it to understand the Perek. I am in the middle of reading it because I'm interested in these things. There you go. Okay, fine. Let's talk a little bit about Kenya, about Kenyan Kesef Doraisa. Just 15 minutes. Tov. The Gemara in Daf Mem Zayin Amud Beis has the following extremely, extremely famous comment.
Excuse me.
Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan said, "Dvar Torah ma'is koines." Minat Torah. Coins acquire things for you. Meanwhile, what does that mean?
As soon as you give somebody coins for a good,
you acquire it. Yeah, exactly. Right. It means you gain legal title to the object upon payment. This is the way the modern economy works. But in that case, why do we say that you need to pull it, leading to a series of dinim that we have in the Mishnah, where you say essentially that you don't, that nobody has rights to the money until you've taken the object that you're buying from them, right? Which is essentially the din the Mishnah outlines. Where did that come from? There's a gzeira. We're afraid that the person who sold, let's say, the wheat, right, would say they got burned down. Right, and he already has the money. Right, let's say your wheat, which was still in my possession because you hadn't moved it out yet, got burned. Very sad. Right, that would have resulted in an unacceptable loss to the person who was making the purchase. So it says, Soif, man deshadad leka bai shalumi. This is the Gemara. What do you mean? Whoever burnt the wheat is now going to have to pay for it. That's called nezek. Right, so the buyer of the wheat's not going to actually lose any money, right? Because that's just regular nezikin, and he's going to have to pay for it. Ella, I'm sorry. What do you say? That's exactly what the Gemara answers, right? Ella, rather, gzeira shema tipo dleka be'oines. Rather, we're afraid that it'll get burned down, and it's not anybody's fault. If it's not anybody's fault, then nobody can be made to pay for the buyer's loss, right? Why is that important? If it belongs still to the seller, then the seller is going to make a real effort to prevent the wheat from getting burnt. Why? Because otherwise he's going to have to give the money back, and he doesn't want to do that. He wants to keep the money, right? If it's not, if it does not still belong to the seller, then he's not going to say, oh, whatever, it's very sad, really. I'm very, very sorry, right? But he's not going to make such a big effort. Therefore, we leave it in the possession of the seller so that he's forced to either save the wheat or give the money back. That way we protect the buyer who, as of yet, has no control over the wheat. Okay? By the way, parenthetically, there is an important exception to this rule, right? On Erev Yom Tov, on Erev Shavuos, on Erev Rosh Hashanah, on Erev Shmini Atzeres, and on Erev Pesach, we leave the din, there's a Mishnah in Chulin that says we leave the din at the din d'oraisa, and mo'is koinos. And the reason why is because in those periods, so many people are buying meat, right, for the Yom Tov, that we want to make it easier for them to be able to just buy meat, right? So we move all obstacles in the way of the purchase, that way everybody who wants to buy meat for the purpose of Yom Tov will be able to buy them, and will be able to buy the meat, and it's Simchas Yom Tov. And then for those periods, we leave it at the Din D'oraisa. But all the rest of the time, the Din D'rabbanan applies.
Why is there an obstacle for the buyer?
It means that a butcher won't be willing to just take money and like worry about if they're going to give the meat over later. Right? They don't want to take money unless they can give the meat over straight away. Right? So just to give everybody a bit more flexibility in how they're managing the purchase. Okay, fine. And then Reish Lakish, Amar Reish Lakish says something different. Meshicha mefereshes min haTorah. Meshicha is explicitly written in the Torah. My time with Reish Lakish. What's the reason? Amar Kra vechisim karumim kar ila misecha kanoi miyad amisecha davar hanikne miyad liyad. Right, right. It says, "O kanoi miyad amisecha, you will buy from the hand of your fellow something which is transferred from hand to hand. Therefore, if you buy metaltalin." The transfer, the physical transfer of the object actually has to happen min haTorah for Reish Lakish. So obviously, Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish, we pass in like Rabbi Yochanan. Yeah? And the question becomes, why does Rabbi Yochanan think that ma'os are koina min haTorah? Okay, what's the easiest possible answer?
He
clearly doesn't darshan the pasuk this way, right? Because he came to a very, very different halacha. But what's the easiest answer to say that why Rabbi Yochanan thinks that Mois koinos min haTorah? Well, that's not going to be metaltalin. That's going to be in karka, right? That's true. You're right, but it's karka. We pass in, you know, even midarabanan ma'itz kona when it comes to karka. I'm sorry. Money is the one thing you can't do a kinyan chalipin with. The way we pass in. Okay, so where is it? Just a minute. Here we go. Go to the Ramban. I've put it on your Daf Makaros, the Ramban. I'm sorry, we have the yeshiva's got new rules now about how you can technically print in the library. I used to be able to print in the library, but now I can't anymore because I need to pay for the printing. So I send out the Daf Makaros to people's computers. This was not possible when I was in Shana'af. Okay, tough. So, it says, right at the end, the second last full line. Ela ikar mashmaosi dekra bekesef udichsev. I can know v'derech knia bekesef. Right, says the Ramban. You don't need any drasha. Pshut toishal mikra is you're giving money and making a purchase. No. Yes, is everything okay? Ah, oh, yeah, yeah. Right, pshut toishal mikra is that money makes purchases. Now, you don't need a reason to disagree. It's obvious that you can buy things with money. And the other possibility is a famous Shittas Rashi from a full Daf Agon, Daf Memvav Amud Beis. I think it was on the Remember Modernize. Yeah, it is. Dibor Amaskal Savar Laka Rabbi Yochanan. I'm not finding it because I'm looking in the Ritva. That makes perfect sense. That makes it very difficult to find it. Right, the Mimvam on base. Right, Savar Laka Rabbi Yochanan, like halfway down Rashi. Right. The Amar Lekaman, because it says in the, it'll say in a little bit in Mimzainam base, Dvar Torah ma is koina is min haTorah. Money can buy things. How do I know? Kedeashkecham gabe koina min haHekdesh. Because we see that even post takana, the way you make a pidyon Hekdesh, the way you buy something from Hekdesh, is by giving the Hekdesh money, and automatically the title is transferred to the person who is not the base Mikdash. Right? Shamra Torah v'nasana kesef v'kamlo, because the Torah says that he gave the money v'kamlo, right? And then it arose for him. It stopped being hekdesh. Okay. This is a famous machlokes shonim. What is the machlokes? Right? What is a Mordechai would say? Well, mamar acharei machlokes, right? We don't have Rabbeinu X here, because we have two options right in front of us. But, Kitzer. Right? What's going on? So, Lichora, the answer is as follows. Rashi thinks that the way you buy things with Kesef is you give over the money. Right? The act of giving the money is the way you then make a kinyan in whatever it is you're buying. In that sense, it is similar, not the same thing, to Chalipin. Right? At least the way we pass it in terms of how Chalipin works. Right, as you're aware, you've done Chalipin already, right? Okay, so Chalipin is a mess. It's Machlokes Amoraim on almost every point about how it works, including who's actually giving the object, the Sutar, what they can give, etc., right? Almost everything is subject to Machlokes, but the way we paskin, right, you give over the object, and that's how you make a Kinyan. Right? It's a symbolic trade. So here, it's a different type of symbolic trade. You give the money, right? And then you automatically gain title. Mina Torah. Well, the reason why we know that works is because we see it works in Hekdesh. There's no reason why the legal title of the base of Mikdash should work any differently to the legal title of anybody else. Right? Now, the Ramban says, no, it's not because the Torah says you give it to Hekdesh and then you get it back. The Ramban actually does disagree with Rashi. He says you can't argue from Hekdesh, you can't learn from Hekdesh to regular Kinyanim. Right? Because we know that in many respects, including pricing, Hekdesh actually works a little bit differently. Right? For example, when somebody's poed their Hekdesh, if it belonged to him originally, he has to add a Chomesh. How much is a Chomesh? What percentage is it? Very good. Right, because it's a fifth of the original, of the total, of the final total, not of the original, not of the original price. So, no, the Ramban says the way it works as an exchange. Right? It's not that I give it and that magically transfers legal title. Right? It's that we have an agreement, in the context of the agreement I give over the money. What's the obvious nafkamina? If we choose to delay the transfer in title, right? According to Rashi, it'll work automatically, right? It'll still work automatically when the title is meant to be transferred, it'll happen. According to Ramban, it won't, right? Because the way it works is it works through the medium of exchange, right? It works in the way that people tend to buy things, which is a medium of exchange, and here we're not exchanging anything. Right, because I'm not receiving title for the object that I bought yet. Yeah? Okay. Fine. That, I think, is what we have time for, because I have reached the end of my time. Like I said we were going to pretend that I had time to do both of the shiurim in full. In fact, I do want to continue doing this next week. Not exactly this shiur, but the related topic of how does the Mashiach work midarabanan. Right, the issues of Kinyan Mashiach midarabanan. I will only say, if you're interested, this exact chakira has a very, very important nafkaminas, bismanas there. These sorts of things don't necessarily have nafkaminas, because anyway we tend to assume, halachically, two things. Firstly, din milchus adina, right? Which means in these sorts of matters, the law of the land is what applies. And secondly, anything which is what's called minhag ha-medina, so anything which is common practice, is an implied agreement. Right? And since we have the right to make agreements which are contrary to Torah law in monetary matters, right, at least in most cases, therefore, right, what will be enforced typically is not what the Gemara says, but whatever is common practice. And if they match, they match. If they don't match, that's fine too. The exception is when we really need a proper halachic kinyan, then we're really machmir that the kinyan needs to be done exactly like the Gemara says. And the most famous case is... No, the opinion of men is actually a little bit complicated in this sense. Because it might not be a purchase, it might be a gift, which might function on a different track. Very good, Mechiras Chametz is the most famous case, I think, of somebody buying an object, right, where we really insist that the kinyan be done halachically min ha-Torah, right? And the reason why is because we need to make sure you really don't own this Chametz, lechol ha-deis, right? So, in that spirit, I have included for you a very short part of a tshuva from Rav Tzvi Feisach Frank. Rav Tzvi Feisach Frank was a big gadol in Yerushalayim from the previous generation, same as Rav Yisrael Zalman Miltz Zichron Levracha, and Rav Shlomo Zalman Zichron Levracha, that generation of Gav Gdolim, right? So he has a shut called Har Tzvi, and I've included for you a short section from a tshuva, a very long tshuva he wrote about all sorts of issues in Mechiras Chametz, which deals directly with this chakira and with this issue. Shkoyev, gentlemen. Thank you.